I will first throw it at Paige, who I've now interviewed like four times, and Mitch, and say, how are you, and what was your highlight so far of being part of the Rock the Block team?
Well, we're great. We're alive. We made it through the block. Awesome. You know, we're still standing.
Yeah, grateful to be there again too, really.
Yeah, I think the highlight was, there are a lot of highlights. This season is insane. I mean, the Ty really pushed us, you know, our creative levels, you know, this guy and the other guy down there, you know, the cute ginger down there, they had to jump off these pirate ships. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was a lot going on the block this year that challenged us, that we got through.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, just to be in the presence of all the other amazing competitors that were there, truly honored to be there with everyone that was involved.
True.
Same unoriginal questions for you, Lindsay and Leslie. Highlight for you so far in Rock the Block, because let's face it, this is not the only amazing, awesome thing that both of you have done.
Oh, thank you very much. We're doing great. Staying busy in life with kids and work. And I think for us, the highlight is always, I think, getting to know new people and making new, really deep relationships in this industry. You know, we went into this season being maybe overly obsessed with Keith and Evan. I can speak for myself. But now having the Baumlers and Mitch and Paige, you know, that are dear friends of ours and are just so creative and incredible, you know, people in the industry, that was incredible. You know, Ty's still hanging around, unfortunately. Yes. I think he's on the edge of retirement. So that'll be really awesome one day. But I would say that's my highlight.
Yeah, I always have a blast just with the people, and I genuinely like being around other creative people and people that are like leveling me up, mm-hmm. and more creative and more like talented than I am or could probably ever be.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
So,
that's true.
Thanks, sister.
Yeah.
And so it just, I actually really, really enjoy that. It pushes me and I like to be challenged like that.
Got it. Now, Keith and Evan, is it the same Mutual Appreciation Society for you two?
Remember, we have your address. We know where you
absolutely
live.
Absolutely, it is not. It was a nightmare from start to finish. These people are divas.
Honesty.
No, it was really fun. It was one of those things where, of course, we saw Leslie and Lindsay were coming back, and that's really fun because we were with them on season 3. And then, of course, we've gotten to meet everybody. Actually, I hadn't met Sarah and Brian, but I think we'd gotten to meet just about everybody else. And, you know, everybody brings such a level of creativity and knowledge to this thing that makes it for, you know, like, it just really is impressive. It's kind of humbling to stand at this competition and be part of it and think, how the hell did I accidentally stumble my way into this? But it was a really great season for talent.
Yeah. Positive stumbling. Before I ask Ty something original, I'll throw an unoriginal question at Brian and Sarah and say, hey, any highlights for you in being part of Rock Block?
I was just going to say that
I think the highlight was getting through it.
Okay, fair. Sarah, were you about to say the same thing?
I'll say that.
I was just going to say that I think after the first season, was so stressful for me that I really didn't enjoy week to week. Like, I was so stressed, and you don't hear your name being called and you lose. So coming back the next season, I was trying to remind myself, like, you just got to have fun. Like, let's enjoy this. Let's push some boundaries. It's an opportunity to spend somebody else's money and just try something. So I think I came at this a little bit different this year. Just like, I got to just soak this all up, do what I want to do, have some fun and enjoy the process, because otherwise the stress gets to you. So I think that's how I approached it from the year before, for sure.
Wow. Well, Ty, an honor.
And that wasn't my entire answer.
Oh, please finish. And
that wasn't my entire answer.
Go, Brad, go.
Yeah. So I was saying, you know, that the highlight was getting through it. And, you know, after getting to tour everybody's space and kind of standing back and looking around and thinking like, holy shit, we've all just been through this. There's four incredible spaces here. Sure. We kind of, you know, everybody put their best on the table, and we're still standing. And it was, that was kind of the, you know, looking around, like we all got through this and we all did what, you know, tens of millions of people would love to be in our position doing the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. And millions of people will watch, and, you know, everyone's going to have a different favorite design and favorite people and favorite moment of the show. Mm-hmm. But I think for us, it was just kind of looking around at each other when the bell went off, and it was like, okay, everybody's still here. We made it.
Yeah.
And that was a good part for me.
Glad to hear that. Now, Ty, coming at you right here, putting you on the spot. I'm wondering if you have the statistic ready. When you hear people who are television industry veterans talk, they'll go, well, I've got 1,000 hours of television. Do you know how many hours of television? Because I bet you're over 10,000 hours of television at this point.
I've got some hours. I've got some weeks. Yeah. I mean, look, we've got some houses under our belt. But here, I wanted to say this, because you've asked everybody what their highlight show was.
Sure.
Right. Well, here's mine. And here's the cool thing about mine is these guys don't even realize getting to the finish line, making these things incredible. They were so exhausted by the time the judging went, they had to go get like 2 hours of sleep somewhere. But I would sneak into their places, and I got to be Goldilocks. I would lay in the tub. I'd look at the view. I would like check out the king size bed. I would like lay on the living room. So I got to experience these spaces the way they didn't get to, because I had the moment to be like, wow, look how amazing these things are. And I sort of got to test drive them before anybody even walked in. So for me, like, I experienced the fruits of their labor, and it was magical. It was amazing. So I was so excited when, you know, you find out like who's going to win or lose this particular thing, because each one was a win. They're just all so different. But for me, that was the highlight of me, like, somebody's going to actually live in this one day. And that's insane. These places are incredible, man. That's all I got to say.
And the follow-up to that, Ty, with the original.
So you ate the porridge.
That was me. That was me. It was cold, by the way. Yeah.
I knew it.
The porridge endorsement's coming soon for you, Brian.
Yeah, yeah.
But Ty, the follow-up to that is, when did you kind of realize that this was going to be a long-term thing with HGTV? Because if we watch HGTV and we don't see your face for 20 minutes, we worry.
Worry.
Hey, man, you know, I'm just glad I'm still doing what I do. Like, look. Like, I've been in this game a long time. Let's face it. There were 2 shows on when I started. Now there's like 200. So the fact that I could still be working with the top tier elite on some of the most fun shows on the network, I'm humbled as well. So look, these guys are as good as they get. And when you get to host a show where the best are competing against the best, like, everybody wants to be involved in that. So I appreciate just being the guy who just gets to say, hey, teams, here's what we're doing today.
Hey, Ty.
And what happens when you and Jeff Probst are in the same room?
We trade necklaces and say, like, who can stay on an island without bug repellent the longest? That'll be the next challenge.
Well, thank you all for speaking with me today. Hope there's more seasons of Rock Block to come. And it's wonderful to see that you are all not just talkers, but doers, creative people who make a difference. So thank you for that as well.
Thank you, man.
I'm assuming it's morning by you. You're on still Pacific or Mountain Time?
Yeah, 10. It's like 10 a.m.
Well, is that
you're on the East Coast?
Is that a usual? Yeah, East Coast in New York. For me, it's okay. I'm starting to wake up. For you, have you always been a morning person, or just when you're doing press?
Yeah, just for press. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to do, you know, I have to have meetings at 7:30 Pacific time with Berlin.
Oof. No, thank you. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I sleep whenever, you know. I guess I spend my adult life in a state of tiredness that makes it possible to catch up a little bit on sleep anytime, day or night, by closing my eyes. I can do it sitting up.
Well, I think that actually is a when you learn to turn the negatives into positives. So the thing is, when you have a low energy persona, anytime you do something high energy, you undersold and over-delivered. Whereas if you see David Lee Roth and he's not talking a thousand words a minute, then you're kind of disappointed.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's talk about Rockmaker. When did you actually finish the record?
Well, it really did drag out for years and years. But it really, you know, it had just gotten so close to perfect, and we had never really made a whole record where every song had to be started with a metal riff, like a metal kind of thrash or punk or whatever you want to call it. But so, you know, there was a lot of perfecting and things. And I think probably 2 months ago, I finally got a master of I'd Like to Help You with Your Problem that, you know, that's the one that's out now. And it was absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
Did things that brought out stuff in the track, the dubby dopeness of the groove. You know, the other mastering, other masterings of it that we had tended to really push the shrieky high end of the guitars, and it's just a little too, like, it came across like that kind of 90s when hair bands had decided they had to be grunge to get on radio.
Yeah, there's some bad talking grunge albums. A lot of those bands, there's a bad rat grunge album. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. I think even the Scorpions attempted that. And
oh, yeah.
But you can't hide a great operatic singer. You can't ask, what's that? What's the singer's name? Why is it escaping me?
Of the Scorpions, that would be Klaus Meine.
Klaus Meine, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't think he tried ball gargling or anything. You know, he's still saying, but I can't, it was so long ago, I can't remember. But yeah, that would have been shameful to hear him going, with his, you know, he never lost his German accent. You know, he always had a German accent. And can you imagine doing the full-on ball gargler with the German? That'd be horrible. And I bet a bunch of them did it. We just never heard it.
Oh, did you ever hear the Accept grunge albums? Or is that going way too deep in the metal for you?
Oh, no, I know Accept, yeah.
Yeah, Accept when...
No, I never... Wow, that is... You're a deep metal guy, right?
I'm a big Dandy Warhols fan, but at the same time, a big metal person. Because for me, it started with the MTV metal stuff. Then I got all Matt Pinfield, 120 Minutes. And then you learn who inspired all the people that like the metal. And then you learn to like a little bit of both. When I first found out about the Dandies, I thought that was like the answer against metal. But obviously Rockmaker shows that you did have the same influences. You just evolved.
Yeah, I was at the perfect age when MTV happened, and at the perfect headspace. Also, the fact that Blondie, Devo, and Bowie existed prior to, you know, what we think of as New Wave, and the successful, you know, I don't know, bringing into popular culture of what would have been Fringe had it not been for MTV, right? So up to then, you know, in life, you had, you know, Run to the Hills was a radio staple, right? I mean, Number of the Beast was on commercial rock radio at the time. Sure. And that's crazy. Great. The 70s. I think when you die, if you're bad, you go to hell. And if you're good, you go to heaven. But if you're really, really fucking good, you get to go to the 70s. So although I must say Run to the Hills was that was 80, I believe. That got released in 80, I think. And Number of the Beast, up. I mean.
I Run to the Hills is one of those songs where, to me, it doesn't necessarily sound like an 80s song. The production doesn't sound dated or anything like that. So there could be a new generation of people who hear it and just don't think of Maiden as an 80s band.
Right, right. To me, it's that the Scorpions, everything, that all things successful arena metal just lumps into the 70s in my childhood for me. It's just, if it's pre-MTV, it's 70s. But, you know, that's, you know, the Dateline doesn't tick over and everybody changes their recording technique, their chord changes, their melodies, their vocal style. No, it doesn't happen. So, I mean, you know, Excalibur looks like a 70s movie, but it's 80, 82 maybe even.
Then you have, you know, further to what you're saying, you have a lot of albums that came out in 90, 91 that we really think of as 80s. So, for example, people call Warrant an 80s band, but Cherry Pie was technically the 90s.
Wow.
I didn't mean to go too weird on you, but we'll keep going back to this album has some special guests. I won't name the one that's embargoed and all that. But
well, how long, when does this come out?
I was going to post this in the next few weeks before the embargo lifts on who that special guest is. But it's incredible that you had them, that you had Frank Black, you have Slash, etc. Did you have a long list of people that you wanted on there, or are these just happenstance one by one?
It really just was about the song and running into an impasse. In recording, you know, nobody in my band, none of us, Brand is also a guitar player, and none of us can do that, you know, Vietnam vet rock LSD thing that I keep talking about, you know.
Yeah.
And it's wah-wah and it just has a thing. And so we had spoken about it, you know, over and over, and oh, how this, oh, that. And our manager at the time just said, okay, let's just say who would be, and it came down to should we reach out to Tony Iommi or should we reach out to Slash?
Mm-hmm.
And we felt that we listened to some Tony Iommi, and he's, you know, he's very proggy and not very Vietnam anymore. Whereas Slash has never changed. He is straight up Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
Just acid trip, wah-wah guitar, wailing in the distance. And boy, what we got out of that was way more. I mean, even had we the chops to do it, harmonically what he's doing has so much more incredible feeling and mastery than any of us could do, even were we able to.
Oh, I think you are competent players, but what happens when you want to play that song live? Do you have the guitar track pre-recorded, or do you have a hired?
Oh, yeah, we don't. No, we don't. We don't. We're not going to play along with tracks and shit like that. No. Well, Pete'll just hit the wah wah, and it'll just go
Yeah.
You know, and it'll be a lot more modern, you know, more modern noise, tripper, swirly stuff. You know, it won't be that. It won't be like authentic like that. But it's cool. It's just live. You know, live songs are different. If we play acoustic, you know, something else had better happen. That's, you just do something to add a little angle, or you know, stretch the thing that's happening in a different direction for a minute, and then, you know, just to create some kind of tension to build towards a release, I guess, is really all the fundamentally on a simple level what the job is.
Sure.
But I mean, our first choice was to have this be as close to a 1970 metal record, you know, formative And it obviously isn't, but it feels like it has the feel. I can't stop listening to it. I smoke pot every fucking day, put on my headphones, I listen to this record, and I listen to that one probably 3 times.
Hey, if you like your album, you're in rare company. So I'm glad to hear that. And
yeah, if you like your album, it's done. That's what we that's how we operate, you know. If you don't like it, it's not done. And we don't, you know, we record every song we write. Mm-hmm. We don't have any songs that didn't go on records.
Wow. Well, if I can keep the compliments coming, you're very rare in terms of lyricists where you are telling a story and you're very sincere, but you never have a shortage of puns. Your pun game has always been strong. So where does that come from? Does that come from just watching endless amounts of stand-up comedy and movies?
Endless amounts of Monty Python? Maybe. I'm guessing here. I don't know. It also comes from being a drummer in every band I've ever been in until the Dandy Warhols. So I had gone to music college, to a jazz college, with a bunch of really, you know, bullet holes in the fucking windows and, you know, heroin addicts for teachers that were, you know, could blow like miles. And I just met, you know, I just met a lot of, you know, music dorks. And there were some kids there that were, you know, also living in my neighborhood across the river, that were also, you know, white kids. And they were in there and they were loving like Queensryche and, you know, Dokken and stuff that I was like, you know, operatic classical metal, which is, you know, anathema to me. And so Pete just said, we got to put a band together that sounds like, so we can meet people that that listen to T-Rex and Galaxy 500 and, you know, shit like that. So that's what we did. And I wanted to make sure that we had nobody in our band that had ever done it before. Didn't Zia, you know, I was one of my best friends at the time, Kirk Peterson, said, hey, there's a chick that works at the coffee shop I work at that wants to be in a band, which everybody did. It was 93, you know.
Yeah.
She's super cool. She's really funny and she's just amazing to work with. And I thought, well, that's great. Does she play anything? And he said, no. And I was like, great. Tell her I'll meet her as soon as possible for coffee tomorrow morning, maybe. And I met her and she was funny and really just kind of badass. And so I showed her the keyboard, you know, 2 black keys, C, right below that. White keys are A to G, and then it starts over and repeats. So where's A? She goes, there. Great. Where's E? There. Okay. Where's G? There. Okay. 4 counts to a major. Then we're going to go 4. Then we're going to 2 on the E, then 2 on the G, then back to the A, right? That kind of thing. And 1, 2, ready, go. And she did it like in that fast of a telling. So wow. I was like, wow, you're in a band. Want to go get lunch and start drinking, you know? So whew, that was cool. Pete, you know, had a guitar, had lessons. But you know, he never played gigs and did any of that kind of stuff and had a band that, you know, I'm sure he had jammed in garages and bedrooms and stuff. Eric Hedford had only been a singer and keyboard programmer and a DJ, but I knew he was a drummer and a really good one because when we were in high school, he was kind of my other downtown hangout in the scene rival. And I think it came from marching band. We were both drummers in marching band and probably symphonic. I don't know. I actually never asked him, but his DJ sets were always, you know, the Charlatans and, You know, Happy Mondays and
all the Britpop stuff.
Yep, yep. So I knew he was going to want to do what we were kind of, me and Pete were kind of doing. And the reason Pete knew that I could do this was because at night when we would get home from the bars, I would go into my room, he'd go into his room, and he could probably hear me a little bit making music, recording on this cassette four track. Yamaha.
Oh, Yamaha. It's
great. It has DBX. So if you pop that, if you recorded the DBX on and pop it off, it is the hissiest, most exciting tape compression. It's got a bunch of, it's got stereo, 7-band EQ. I learned about, you know, I recorded myself and learned how to get what you want. I've never learned how to make a pro sounding record. We have to find other people with different talents and skill set for that. But I know how to make it feel cool, like what I want it to feel like. So,
yeah, if I can rudely interrupt you and compliment you, it's just been decades of the guy who's calling the shots, who knows what he wants done and what it to sound like, but he's publicly pretending to be like the slacker who doesn't care.
Are you describing somebody we know?
I mean, that's kind of been the case where it's the hardworking guy who put in the time and the effort, but publicly he's like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I'm not acting. I certainly don't know how to act. I've tried. Trust me, it's shameful. But yeah, I mean, there's so much I don't know about, and we fuck up so much, and I fuck up so much. It's been really great to have a band together for this long because, you know, in the first 5 years, you know, we did a lot of recording and went from my bedroom to, you know, a Grammy winning, one of the most legendary mixers of all time, Chad Blake.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, now here we are at this point, everybody in my band is a great artist and a great recording artist and understands fully what the job is. So I can get away with doing a lot less. And as I'm not a young man, I'm no longer a 20 nothing drinking and smoking, you know, I can't do as much because I still, you know, I still like to get drunk. It's now French wine. Mm-hmm. And now it's not joints and bongs. It's vape pens, which is kind of a grossly clinical and, you know, weird way to go about it. But as long as the pens are long and elegant and feels all right. So yeah, I'm probably, you know, bordering on useless. Now this, it's imminent. I can see it looming in the distance. Yeah. See, I just forgot again where I was going. Outro.